Welcome, friends. This is Richard Wolff. This is Economic Update for this week, the end of March 2014. Economic Update is a weekly analysis of the economic dimensions of our lives, our jobs, our incomes, our debts, our futures, our college student loans, all of that. I'm a professor of economics all my adult life. I currently teach at the New School University in New York City, and I also write columns for truthout.org, an independent source of news and analysis that I urge you to take a look at every day, truthout.org. If this program and the kinds of analyses we offer are interesting to you, please know that we maintain two websites where you can go at any time that's convenient for you, at no cost whatsoever, to find the links, the connections, more of this material, lectures, TV interviews, entire classes, as you like. The first one is rdwolf.com with two Fs, and the second one is democracyatwork.info. Not only will these free websites provide you with lots of information and support and links to other materials, but they also have two other functions. The first is to allow you to communicate with us, to send us your questions, comments, criticisms. We read them all and use them to design the programs week after week with your input. And the second thing you can do is click on the appropriate symbols to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Pinterest. Just go to either website, rdwolf.com, or democracyatwork.info, and you will be part of the entire process of these programs. Okay, let me turn then to the economic updates for now. The first one concerns a problem going on in all 50 states. This has to do with the states being in trouble because of the economic downturn, the number of people unemployed who therefore don't pay income taxes, the number of people worried about their jobs and futures who therefore cut back on consumption, which means they don't pay the sales taxes that fuel most of our state governments, etc., etc. And one of the places where state governments are cutting back in the United States are in supporting public higher education, the universities, state college systems, community colleges, that are preparing the large majority of our young people who go to college for their job futures and thereby shaping the future of the American economy. In a show of the irrationality of our economic system, we now see that where more than ever before the future of the American economy depends on the quality and quantity of trained young people coming out of higher education, we are in the process of savaging and cutting back on our private education system. This is a massive process of shooting yourself in the economic foot. But I want to talk about a particular case, the case of the state of Maine, and in particular a university there, the University of Southern Maine, located in Portland, Maine. The first thing to say is that they're suffering cutbacks. Indeed, the president of the university rather proudly boasts that she is cutting back on many jobs. The university currently has 310 full-time faculty instructors. The president said her goal is to reduce that to 280. That's a 10% cut. In this round of layoffs, she refers to others. Theodora Calico, the president of the university, has been cutting in the following departments: art, economics, English, philosophy, sociology, theater, music, public policy, and the honors program. Oh, she cuts a wide swath of damage and victimization of students. But let's look a little more deeply into this situation in the University of Southern Maine. As recently as 1999, so 15 years ago, the state of Maine provided approximately 63% of the cost of students going to the university system. The students themselves had to come up with 37% of the cost. That is tuition and the basic fees that run the university. And the idea behind this, and this has been true for decades, is that the public benefits by the larger number of people able to get an affordable public higher education, and that therefore it's appropriate to use state money to help finance that public service. 15 years later, what's the relationship? The state now provides 33% of the cost, and 62% is covered by the students themselves. In other words, in 15%, we have reversed the proportion of the cost of a higher education that is carried by the state and shifted it on to the families and the individuals, the young people involved. So outrageous was the rising cost of education that the students demanded something be done, and a freeze was imposed in 2012. That is, tuition wouldn't go up anymore. So how interesting that a year later we begin to see that the next phase, when you can't shift the burden of education onto the individual families, what do? You lay off the teachers. You say, in effect, to the students, we've charged you way more than we ever did, and now we're going to cut the faculty, so give you less for charging you more. And why is this happening? Simply because in an economic crisis, we have a government so controlled by corporations and the rich that even though they've had their taxes cut for 40 years, even though the rich are richer than they have ever been in at least a century, even though the bailouts from this crisis have gone chiefly to the rich in the stock market and to large corporations, the states in this country will not tax those folks because they control the political money. And so what are they going to do? Raise the cost of public services like higher education and cut what they deliver to these higher cost public education students, namely cut the faculty, cut the programs. And here's how it works. The government goes to the administrators of the universities and says, we're giving you a lot less than we used to. Ha, ha, ha. You know, we're being fiscally prudent. And then the administrators are then deciding who to cut. And at that point, a lovely situation arises. The administrators, the top of the hierarchy of public higher education, are basically being paid here to be the hatchet men and the hatchet women of this system. They go around cutting whoever they don't like, reshaping the university in whatever image they prefer, because they're immune. Very few of them get cut. They're the cutters, not the cuttees. And so we have this whole ugly process of starving higher education and giving the administrators a chance to do whatever feathers their nest best, and which may have very little to do with public education. The important thing about the University of Southern Maine is not that this is happening. It's happening across the country. The important thing is that the students and the faculty are fighting back. Across the country, stories have been carried about the demonstrations, the commitment of the students and the faculty together to not let this process go forward. That's the hope, and that's the importance of the University of Southern Maine. Let me turn next to a very short story. It has to do with what's called unintended consequences. When the crisis hit in 2007, one of the first things that was done, and it was carrying forward something the Federal Reserve had been doing for years, was to cut interest rates, to make it possible for the Federal Reserve to lend huge amounts, trillions of dollars, to the biggest banks in the United States and to some of the biggest corporations like General Motors and so on, at ridiculously low rates. This was thought to be a genius stroke, cutting the rates so that these institutions could be recovering from the crisis they largely caused by using cheap government money provided to them at a low interest rate. Problem. When you lower interest rates, you affect everybody who depends on interest rates. And what's emerging now is that includes the retirees of America, the very rapidly growing portion of our population, a fifth or so, that are in the age when they depend on retirement income. And much of that is certificates of deposits in banks, is savings accounts in banks, in what we call fixed income. Things that are investments built up with a lifetime of savings, but that depend on the interest rates. And when you make interest rates low, the retirees, what they can get for the money they have saved, is very low. causing a deepening of the crisis for old people, which of course becomes a crisis for everybody, since when the old people can't have enough to survive, they have to turn to the younger people, their kids, to help them out. Next item. An attentive listener to this program brought to my attention two remarkable bits of information together. The first has to do with the story of a wonderfully wealthy group of people, Vincent and, what's his wife's name? Mrs. Viola. Vincent Viola, I'll get his wife's name for a minute, I want to be fair, Teresa. Vincent and Teresa Viola. They have put on the market their lovely Upper East Side New York City mansion at the eye-popping price of $114 million. To be exact, $114,077,000 is the price of their one-family mansion. 20,000 square feet plus 2,500 square feet of outdoors, three-tier roof deck, and glimpses of Central Park. You get the picture. So these are very wealthy folks. Teresa Viola explains in a story in the New York Times on December 13th of last year, quote, "We lived at the Waldorf Astoria, arguably New York City's finest hotel, for the first 3 years of the renovation." You can only imagine what it cost to live for 3 years in one of the most expensive hotels in the country. But that's why they were waiting for the renovation. And now, having lived there for a few years, they've decided to move on and sell, and charging for the house $114 million. Why is this interesting, other than a sign of obscene wealth in a country where the majority of people are struggling just to get by? The reason this story is important is that Vincent Viola is also the owner of the Florida Panthers hockey team. And this is interesting because he's engaged in a fight down there in Florida with Broward County officials, because he wants a subsidy. He wants the county government to give him a subsidy, and here we go, $80 million worth, so that he can build a hotel and have it all help his Florida Panthers hockey team. And as usual, he has his people telling everybody how wonderful this will be for Florida. But what he wants is $80 million. To make it possible to run his profitable hockey team. The same man wants to squeeze the people of Broward County for $80 million freebie while he sells his New York City mansion for $114 million. That's how the rich become richer. They take the money of the mass of people as subsidies, threatening not to do what they might otherwise not do, even as they sell their homes for wild sums of money. The extremity, the ease with which this is done, funding already rich people with public subsidies, is what got my attention and what I think deserves yours. Next short item. Student football players at Northwestern University just got a really interesting ruling from the Chicago District of the National Labor Relations Board. Basically, the board agreed with these young students that they are workers, that they are a football-playing franchise that is making millions of dollars for the university that employs them. Oh, sure, the university goes through the charade of calling these people students. As a professor all my life, I can tell you that the students who get the big, fat athletic fellowships are not there to study, which they often don't do much of. And I'm being as polite as I know how here. They're there to make money for the university. They're there to play football, and they know it. They get rewarded for that. And if they get an education along the way, that's well and good. But that's not the point, and that's not the purpose. And everybody who knows anything about this knows that. And so the students, for the first time, have said, look, if we're the way that the university makes millions, we ought to be given some sort of opportunity to get reasonably well paid. Giving us a scholarship is a tiny fraction of what would otherwise have to be paid to the kinds of talent that's bringing in these big bucks to the university. Bravo for these student athletes, at least they have the courage to begin to fight. They're forming a union, and they're demanding the right to negotiate with the university, and the National Labor Relations Board has agreed with them. A couple of other short updates that I think are important. The BBC, the British Broadcasting Corporation, did a recent summary done by their news office in Washington, D.C., led by Debbie Siegelbaum. And I wanted to cite the numbers she does because it's a way for me to summarize the unemployment situation, which we should never lose sight of since it's a basic measure of how badly this economic system performs. So here are the numbers she released as of the 25th of March, 2014, carried over the BBC. Number of people currently employed in the United States right now, 10.5 million people. By the way, that does not count the number of people who have left the labor force over the last 6 years, and it doesn't count the number of people that are in part-time jobs but who want full-time jobs but can't find them. If you counted those two, it doubles the number to over 20 million. But we'll stay with the 10.5 million. It gives you a sheer number of the number of folks unemployed. The number of those people who have been unemployed for more than 27 weeks, that's over half a year, 3.8 million of our fellow citizens. Back in 1950, the average length of unemployment, 11.8 weeks. The average unemployed person was out of work 11.8 weeks. In 2014, the average amount of unemployment for a person on that unemployment, for those 10.5 million, 37.1 weeks. More than three times what it was in 1950. The average number of times that a Fortune 500 CEO, that's the chief executive officer of the 500 biggest corporations, how much larger is it right now than the average worker's salary? Not the bottom worker, the average. And that average includes them. The average in these 500 companies versus the CEO. The CEO gets 204 times what the average worker gets. Last short update that we will have time for today has to do with the chairman of the Nestle Corporation, Peter Brabeck. He gets in the news regularly, and we have to pay some attention each time, but we don't have the time, so I'm going to do it now for all the times in the past. Why is the chairman of Nestle famous? Well, you might think it's because Nestle is one of the biggest food companies in the world, if not the biggest. You might think, since what we're going to talk about is water, that it might be because Nestle is the largest producer and seller of bottled water in the world. Well, the real reason isn't that. The real reason is something that Peter Brabeck said in an interview back in 2005, and this interview gets replayed over and over. And here's why. I went back, by the way, to listen and watch the video so I could be sure of what I'm telling you about today. In this interview, Peter Brabeck of Nestle says, "Water, access to the water we need to live, is not a human right." Unmistakably clear, he says that. It should be a commodity priced in the market that people have to buy. And sure, if there are some people who can't afford it, maybe something could be... He waves that away. He says to say that water is a right in the video is an extreme position that he pushes aside. Well, he got a lot of grief about that. It struck an awful lot of people around the world that to say human beings don't have a right to water is basically condemning them to die, since that's what we have if we don't get sufficient water in our systems. So Mr. Brabeck and the Nestle Corporation, watching the avalanche of negative publicity for them, backed off. And in many statements saying, oh no, water is a right, I was misunderstood, there's no misunderstanding. In fact, if you look at the video, what you see is a Mr. Brabeck explaining that water should be treated, and this is very revealing, like all other kinds of food, he says. We pay for wheat, we pay for meat, we pay for fruits and vegetables, and we should pay for water. Oh, this is getting interesting. I like this. We want to see water handle like food. Let's run it the other way. If access to water should be a right, which they admit, well, gee, might it not apply to access to food? Might it not apply to access to medical care and education? Aren't these rights, too, to live a decent life? And if rights are what we're considering, then maybe we ought to take another look at this business about pricing things like water, food, medical care in the market. The justification of that Mr. Brabeck offers is what comes from the professors of economics. And Mr. Brabeck ought to know better because he doesn't listen to them on much else. Do prices in a market teach us something useful the way the professors say? Are prices a measure of scarcity? And the answer here is an unqualified no. What prices are in a market is a way of handling scarcity, not of measuring it. Here's what scarcity is. You don't have enough of something. You need it, like food, water, medical care, and education. We need that. And there may not be enough to give everybody as much as they want of food, water, education, and so on. And when we put prices, when we let markets work, here's what we do. We say to all the people who want and need water, food, and so on, you bid for it in the market. You want it, you pay for it. And here's what happens. Those who have a lot of money can bid up the price of something that's scarce. And as the price goes up, because the people with money are prepared to use their money to get it, the price goes up and it forces other people who can't afford it to no longer make the demand. So the goods aren't any more scarce because we figured out a way to remove part of the population. That's what markets do. They price things out of reach. So here's the example with water. If you're rich, you don't just want water to drink. You don't just want water to bathe. You want water to take care of your pet. You want water to water your lawn. You want water to keep the greens on the golf course looking spiffy. You want water because you're rich for all the kinds of activities. So you'll pay because you have the money. You'll pay the fees to let the golf course buy the water. You'll pay the fees to water your own lawn. And as the price of water gets bid up, the poor can't buy it anymore. They have to economize. We get rid of scarcity by not distributing it to the people who can't afford it. Is this noble? No, this is ugly. And this is fundamentally inhuman and unjust. And you know, the United States government recognized that. Back in World War II, we knew that to fight a war, we needed to use a lot of our resources to take care of fighting a war, to defeat the Japanese and the Germans in World War II. So we said, wow, there'll be a scarcity of sugar and coffee and gasoline and meat and butter and all kinds of things. Now, we could let the market work, and then the price would be bid up by the rich, and the poor would drop out because they couldn't afford it. We could allocate, we could distribute by means of the market. But the United States government didn't do that. It said, no, 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 we can't have that. We can't have a few rich people having all the milk they want for their pets, while average people cannot get enough milk for their babies. So we're not going to let the market do it. We're going to issue ration cards. We're going to give everybody the right to have so much water, depending on what they need, and so much butter and sugar and gasoline. We're not going to use the market because it doesn't measure scarcity. It allocates scarcity to those with the best ability to pay, and that's fundamentally unjust and unacceptable. That's the problem with the mentality of the people who lead our big corporations, like Mr. Brabeck of Nestle's. Okay, we come to that part of our program where we begin to talk about some major issues that take a little more time and that we need to devote attention to. And I'm going to begin today by making a distinction between distribution and redistribution. This is an issue that comes up often in the United States, and indeed in almost every other country. And the discussion goes a little bit like this. Every economy distributes the values of what it produces. Think of an economy as producing an enormous amount of goods and services, which you can value at whatever it is, in dollars, in lira, in euros, whatever. And the question that every society has to answer is, how are you going to distribute the wealth that's been created in this economy among all the people in it? And not just the people, between the people on the one hand and corporations, the producers, the enterprises, on the other, and what part is going to go to the government. In other words, a decision about the distribution has to be made. And the way this works in most economies today is basically the corporations make those decisions. The corporations decide how much to pay their workers. The corporations decide how much to pay each other for inputs. They negotiate that. They work that out, and they decide what the price is of everything, and that'll determine how much profits they get. So the wages the workers get, the profits the companies get, is pretty much decided by the enterprises in the normal course of capitalist economic activity. Here comes the problem. The way capitalism typically does it is to give a relatively small number of people at the top a disproportionate amount of the wealth created in society, while the mass of people are either in the middle, getting by reasonably well, or at the bottom, not getting by reasonably well. And predictably, and this has been especially true in recent years for reasons you all know, the people at the top have been doing really well. The people in the middle are literally disappearing as the middle vanishes. And those toward the bottom are ballooning as a part of our population. And this has led, as capitalism has always done this, to demands that the wealth that's been distributed so unequally now be redistributed. And indeed, we have methods for doing that. For example, progressive income taxes. We tax a higher percentage of rich people's income than of middle and lower, and we use that to provide public services that are distributed to everybody. This is a method of redistributing income so that we use the tax system to redistribute what was initially distributed in what is deemed to be an unfair and unsustainable way. Subsidies are another way of doing that. Welfare payments are another. And typically, and here comes the point, typically in our societies, we have bitter, ugly battles in the society over redistribution. Those who get more want even more. Those who get too little demand more. Those who see themselves having some of their income taken back to provide to others feel ripped off. And so we have nasty, ugly struggles. That's how the United States Congress, for example, recently decided, at the same time that they're giving dozens of benefits to the rich, to cut back on food stamps for the poor, and on and on and on. These are ugly struggles over redistribution. Well, I have a suggestion. It's not to favor this or that method of redistribution. It's actually to say, you know, it's irrational for a society to have these kinds of ugly fights, to become so divisive in our politics and our ideology over a question of redistributing income, that we ought long ago to have said, well, wouldn't it be better to not distribute it unequally in the first place so that we don't have these kinds of divisive social battles about redistribution afterwards? Maybe if we distributed it in a reasonably fair, equitable way in the first place, we wouldn't have these fights. And moreover, you know, to redistribute wealth is not only the occasion of ugly and divisive social battles. It costs a lot of money. Bureaucracies have to be set in place to measure and count and take and monitor all of the redistributed wealth. We could save on that waste of our resources. And we could avoid the battles. Here's the solution. distribute better in the first place. And here's how to get it done. Change from a capitalist enterprise, one that's owned and operated by a tiny group of major shareholders, the rich, and the boards of directors they select from among themselves, who decide how to distribute the wealth of the enterprise. Don't let them do it, because you're letting a small group enrich themselves by how they distribute the wealth we all create. That's the problem. The solution? Worker self-directed enterprises, worker co-ops. Why? Because if all the workers together in an enterprise, enterprise after enterprise, stores, factories, offices, if the workers collectively decided how to distribute the wealth that each enterprise produces, you think they would give a tiny group of people at the top most of it and then scramble among each other for the rest? No. They wouldn't distribute it as unequally as capitalism has been doing, and they never would. And therefore, we wouldn't have the kind of redistribution fights and wastes that we now have. We would solve the problem at the beginning, which is where it ought to be solved. By changing the organization of enterprises, we could get the kind of more equal distribution that would be a much better solution. We're going to take a short break at this midpoint in the program. Please stay with us. We'll be back in a matter of seconds for Economic Update. Yes, sir. Richard Wolff. This is Economic Update for the end of March 2014. And we're in the middle of the program where I typically remind you that if these conversations and discussions and analyses are of interest, please make use of our two websites, rdwolff.com and democracyatwork.info. Both of those are freely available to you 24/7, and they both allow you to do two other things. Communicate with us. Your thoughts, questions, ideas, criticisms, all are welcome, all are read. We use them to design these programs. And the other thing you can do on either website is to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Pinterest and keep up in a regular way. And there is one more thing I forgot to mention. You can sign up for our free newsletter. That way, every couple of months, you get a little announcement, and a free newsletter takes up one page or so, giving you a sense of what we're doing and highlighting some of the things that you can click on and pursue, again, at your interest, no cost whatsoever. The next major conversation for today's program has to do with the state of Maryland. This is the M program. We talked about Maine at the beginning of the first half, and we're going to talk about Maryland at the beginning of the second. Why Maryland? Because Maryland illustrates the extreme inequalities we now face as a society and will continue to face unless, like the students and faculty at the University of Southern Maine, we fight back. So what is it that's interesting about Maryland? Well, Maryland is the United States that has, first fact for you, the most millionaires as a percentage of the population. The most millionaires per capita, that's the state of Maryland. And recently, the state of Maryland showed the power of all these millionaires. When the legislature in Maryland, with a thumping bipartisan majority, these are the words of a website that follows these things, which I have used in the past and which I would like to mention here. It's called TooMuchOnline.org. TooMuchOnline.org. They had a wonderful story about this, and not only did they talk about what the legislature did, but they allow me to present it to you. They voted to cut the state's estate tax, a move that will save the state's richest households and chop state revenues by $431 million over the next 5 years. Even the Baltimore Sun, the leading newspaper in the state of Maryland, wrote an editorial from which I want to quote. The editorial asked this question, quote, "If you had $431 million to spare, is a tax cut for the ultra-rich where you would spend it?" Wow. The unequivocal answer given by the Maryland State Legislature is, yes, that's exactly what we would do. We may be cutting public services. We may be laying off public employees. We may be worsening the lives of most of our people, but we're going to help the rich, because that's who we listen to. We are today's modern politicians in both parties. But this alone would not have made me talk about Maryland. I want to talk about something else that the legislature and the governor of Maryland have also been doing. And here I use work by Daniel Costa, who writes for the Economic Policy Institute in Washington. EPI.org is where you can find it. And on the 15th of March, Daniel Costa talked about the new minimum wage legislation just passed in Maryland. Now, this is the same legislature, same governor, who just gave away $431 million to the already richest people in the state that has more millionaires per person than any other state. Okay, they're going to raise the minimum wage to $10.10 an hour. But along the way, here are some of the things. They're not going to do it until 2017. Why be in a rush? You might be in a rush to save money for the millionaires in a cut estate tax. That's a rush matter. But helping the people at the bottom, there's no rush. So they will go to 10-10, but only over several years, because we're not in a rush. But what about minimum wage for tipped workers, workers who get a tip on top of their wage? Currently in the state, it's not $8 an hour, the minimum wage in the state. It's $3.63, and the new law doesn't change it. Let me say that again. The new law, which raises the minimum wage for everybody else, doesn't raise it for tipped workers, the people who work in restaurants, hotels, and so on. Why? Well, it's the same answer. Just like the cut in the estate tax is the political effect of the millionaires using their money, the reason you raise the minimum wage, but not for tipped workers, is the effect of the companies that rely on such workers. One of the biggest lobbyists in Maryland is the Six Flags Corporation, the amusement parks, has a long history of lobbying to keep the minimum wage low. So these kinds of companies that want to, they get what they want, just like the millionaires get what they want. And so the gap between rich and poor, the gap between those who amuse themselves with lots of money at the amusement park and those who get $3.63 for an hour of their labor in that amusement park is continuing. This is a society that is spinning out of control in the direction of inequality. And it is a process that starts with the private interests, wealthy people in Maryland getting their estate tax cut, interested corporations leaning on the politicians to keep wages low when they want them low. They get the result. And the rest of us live in a society more and more split between the extremes of wealth and income. And this will continue as long as we permit it. The last major conversation for today continues the critique of capitalism that many of you have asked me to conduct, and which I've been doing over recent programs. We talked about the system being subject to critique as part of its life. All economic systems are subject to critiques. There is nothing new about it. It's just that we live in a society that's afraid to think about them, to face them, and so I can perform a public service by going over it. And what we talked about last time were these cycles. The system is prone to ups and downs that are wildly irrational. Periods of time like the one we're in now, when millions of people are without work, when huge proportions, roughly 20% of our tools, equipment, factory, and office space sits idle. This is a stunning demonstration of a system with major flaws. Why? Because this is a waste of resources. It hurts the people who are unemployed. Now for 37 weeks on average, you lose your skills, you lose your contacts, you lose your self-confidence, your self-esteem. The social costs of this are staggering. And I'm not even talking about the machines that rust, the floors that buckle, and all the other losses from a system that works this way. So it is staggeringly inefficient to have a system that does this. That's right. What good is the efficiency inside the factory or the office that we so often boast about, if it is completely nullified and offset by the inefficiency of the huge number of people without a job, the huge number of stores sitting empty, the huge number of factories quiet? That's inefficiency at the macro level, trumping whatever efficiency you get at the micro level inside the enterprise. But the other criticisms of capitalism are just as important. It is fundamentally unjust, the critics have argued. It enriches a tiny number of people at the expense of everybody else. This is a fundamentally unjust arrangement. Everybody works hard, everybody's work contributes to the total output, and everybody should be reasonably well compensated, some more than others for all kinds of reasons. They need it more, they work harder, they have more developed skills. You can take those into account, but that has nothing to do with having, as this program began with today, somebody who is selling their home for $114 million. This is outrageous, has nothing to do with your relative contribution to the process. This has to do with a system that rewards folks in a manner reminiscent of the ancient pharaohs, the folks who built pyramids while other people had not enough to eat. And finally, the critique of capitalism has to do with democracy. And here the argument is stark, but needs to be put forward in a straightforward manner. Democracy is a concept that says that the people affected by decisions have the right to participate in them. We say people have the right to vote in an election because the mayor you vote for, or the governor you vote for, or the congresspersons, or the president, these are people who make decisions that affect your lives, and therefore they have to be subject, in a democratic system, to your influence, at least your vote. Well, if democracy is a good idea, if it's a value we hold dear, which every political leader says two or three times a day, if democracy is that in whose name we go to war in Iraq and Afghanistan and justify all manner of foreign policy, wouldn't you think that democracy would have to operate and function inside the workplace, where we work? After all, work is an important institution. 5 out of 7 days a week, you go to work. Much of the rest of your life, you're either recovering from work or preparing for work. Work is central. And work in this country is mostly done in enterprises. Are enterprises democratically organized? And the answer is an unqualified no, they're not. You're affected by many decisions where you work. Let's go through them to remember. You're affected by the air you breathe and the water you drink. Do you determine the quality of the air and the water in your workplace? And the answer is, no, you don't. Another example. You're affected if your company closes your office, your store, your factory, and moves it someplace else. Do you participate in the decision of when and where to move? No, you don't. When it comes time to deciding what to do with the profits in the store or office or factory where you work, profits that your labor helped to produce, do you participate in the decision of what is done with those profits? And the answer is, you don't. Are you affected by it? Of course you are. If those profits were distributed back to you as a bonus at the end of the year, your income and your life would be different. If instead that money is given to a bonus of the five richest guys in the company at the top, you're affected by the fact you didn't get it. They did. So you're affected by how the profits are distributed, but you're excluded from participating in the decision about how those profits are distributed. So whether you have a job, what the conditions on the job are, and what share of the output you help to produce you get, those are key decisions that affect your life, and you are undemocratically excluded from them inside a capitalist enterprise. Capitalism and democracy are opposites. They're not partners in the way we're told. They're not institutions reinforcing each other. Capitalist enterprises hate the participation of workers. That's why they oppose unions, because unions begin to have some influence. And workers united can get some influence, which individually they cannot. And that influence has to be given to them by their strength, not by some decision of the board to try something for a while, maybe. So if you want democracy, the critics of capitalism argue, you've got a problem with capitalism. Think about it. And think about it as an alternative way of thinking to the oft-repeated claim that the goals of the United States, a capitalist economy, are all about democracy. Might we be a nation, like so many others, afraid to admit that its foreign policy and its domestic policies are governed by the protection and support of capitalism, but all of it done in the name of a democracy which those who make those claims exclude from their own institutions? The criticism of capitalism as unstable, the cycles, inefficient, the cycles, unjust, the inequality, and undemocratic by excluding the majority of people from the decisions that affect their work lives and their economic lives, that's no minor matter. That's no dismissive side point. That goes right to the heart of the justification for a system like this. We turn now to the final part of the program where I respond to your questions. And the one I want to start with today, and I want to thank this person, but I didn't get their permission to use their name, and unless I get your permission, I don't mention the name of the person who brought this to my attention. But this question had to do with a recent interview on C-SPAN with Bill Gates, the founder and still major shareholder of the Microsoft Corporation, widely known as one of the richest men in the world. And he gave an interview where he said two things, and this listener asked me to comment. Now, normally I don't comment on individuals' comments, but given the prominence of Mr. Gates and given the widespread views he articulates here in this interview, I'm going to make an exception. The first thing Bill Gates says is how happy and positive he feels that the world is getting better steadily. And he has no patience in this interview for people who are saying that isn't so, because they're really doing harm. They don't help the situation by not saying that the world is getting better. Well, since I am one of those folks, I have to quarrel a little bit with Bill Gates. I begin, as politely as I know how, by asking him which planet he inhabits. The world is getting better. I began this program by talking to you about what's going on to the public universities in this country. Built after World War II, public higher education was a way to give the mass of Americans a chance to go to college, even though they could not afford to get into, pay the price, or even find a place in the fancy private schools that before World War II had only educated the richest tiny minority of American young people. And what did I report? The struggles across 50 states as the states cut back their commitments to the mass of working people in all 50 states. I gave the details in Maine as representative. The world isn't getting better for the mass of people looking for a higher education. It's getting worse. And Mr. Gates, who claims that education is one of the priorities of his foundation, the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, it is astonishing, even for these folks who are so busy justifying themselves, to be able to say baldly things like everything's getting better. You must be kidding. Then I talked about the problem of old people having to live on much lower interest rates because of the policies of the government. Things aren't getting better for them. And then I talked about the tip, the people who live on tips in Maryland, and how they're not getting a raise in their minimum wage of $3.63 an hour. Wow. Things are not getting better, Bill Gates. Well, let's turn to the other thing he said, which in a way is even more astonishing. He refers, and this is in the description of C-SPAN as it gives of this interview, he refers to the role of philanthropy, and Mr. Gates in the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation is one of the major philanthropic foundations in the country. The role of philanthropy in ensuring justice. Let me say that again. Ensuring justice. Now let's see. Justice. Mr. Gates endowed this foundation, which he runs, with hundreds of millions of dollars. I'm going to put aside how he ever came by that money and how it's possible in a society, many of whose institutions and individuals contributed to producing the modern computer, why one individual would end up with this wild amount of money. But put that aside. He gives it to a foundation that he and his wife run. Now let's look at the justice here. They decide where the hundreds of millions of dollars are going to be used. They decide what social issue they're going to help out. They thereby decide what social issues they're not going to help out. Are you a person with a drug addiction problem? If they don't think that's important, your help is reduced. If they think it's important to help early childhood education in Africa, then they will help that. Is it just for an individual family to decide who among the needy of the world are going to be helped? Might it be more just to say that the society as a whole, all of whom face the sadnesses and the needs of our communities, all of whom struggle with them, all of whom will be affected by who's helped and how, but they're all excluded because we have an arrangement in which if you're rich enough, you can decide, you can play God with your wealth. And this is about justice? Justice would be if all the folks who suffer the pains of the needs of our society, could get together and decide democratically what priority to give which of them, how to help them. Why is this left to a handful of people? We didn't elect Mr. Gates. No social procedure evaluating him as adequate ever took place. He's in a position to decide who gets help and who doesn't simply by virtue of his money and by no other standard. That has nothing to do with democracy. And it has nothing to do with social justice. Mr. Gates, the world isn't getting better, and you're not ensuring justice. The world is getting poorer, and you play a major role in that. And your foundation is a fundamentally unjust way of dealing with the world's problems. You don't ensure justice, you illustrate injustice. We've come to the end of our time. I want to thank you, as I always do. I want to also inform you at the end of this program that we are now on about 25 stations around the United States. We have grown from one station in March of 2011. We are very proud of this growth. More stations are contacting us. We are also now on television in Manhattan, in New York City, on the Manhattan Neighborhood Network, and I want to appreciate that interest of the MNN in our work. So it is with great pride that I sign off for today, but that I'm signing off to an ever-growing audience, sending me ever more emails, which I appreciate. I look forward to being with you again next week.
My time, babe. It ain't gonna change. Change, change, change. Change, change, change.